But my, like, you know, rebellious anti-government spirit really got perked again. And I was like, you know what? I don't think these AI people, as smart as they are, understand what's coming, you know, because a lot of them have come from an academic world, and they haven't been like born in the cauldron of regulatory fire like the crypto folks have.
Welcome to the ATX DAO podcast, the hub for exploring the forefront of blockchain technology and Austin's Web3 community. Your hosts, Nick, Mason, Luke, and Ash, connect you with innovators within ATX DAO and beyond as we venture into the world of decentralized technology. So crack open a beer and join us for a front row seat to learn about the innovations and trends shaping our digital future. This is the ATX DAO podcast.
So, Eric, I was asking before we started, like, should we even ask you to give an intro, or should we assume everybody knows who you are? We figured probably best, just for those who may not have heard about you, to do a quick intro. So can we start with that?
For the two people left in crypto who haven't heard about you, or who haven't watched your permissionless talk.
Crypto is growing. There's a ton of people that have no idea who I am. I think that's always a good sign, right? Like, if every person I meet has already met me before, that means that the industry is not growing anymore.
Yeah, so, good point.
I would say probably most people in crypto don't know who I am, but let's do a quick intro and fix that. I'm Eric Voorhees. I've been in Bitcoin since 2011, which makes me an old man. I got interested because, basically I felt like the money system of the world was broken, primarily because it's centrally planned and controlled, which seems very Soviet to me. Like, to centrally plan money is appropriate, I would think, for the USSR, but not for America. And yet we have a central bank managed by the government that sets the price of money, and thus all prices in the economy are manipulated in more or less degree by that. So I felt like that was a big problem and just didn't really know how to solve it, you know. And then I come across Bitcoin and I'm like, wow, this is interesting. And I realized that it can't be stopped. That, like, you can't turn the thing off. There's no office you can raid or servers you can shut down. And of course it was a long shot, you know. It grew really out of such a tiny little niche community, but I realized, like, if it was going to work, it would be a complete revolution for the whole world. And I fell in love with it and have been building in this ecosystem ever since. So I'm probably best known for Shapeshift, which was my company from 2014 until we decentralized in 2021. So eight years. Before that, I built Satoshi Dice, which was the big Bitcoin gambling casino back in the day. Half of all the Bitcoin transactions from Genesis Block up until 2013 were to or from Satoshi Dice. And worked with Charlie Shrem at BitInstant in New York around the same time. So that's been, you know, the broad stroke of my history with this. And I continue to be inspired and excited by it every day.
That's great. Before we jump into maybe your relationship with Shapeshift these days, curious, you know, in terms of your rabbit hole story, everybody's got one in this space. And was there a person or a particular moment in your path where you were like, oh yeah, I get it. That's world changing, or it could be.
I mean, it happened pretty quickly. So I saw a Facebook post. This was May of 2011, like early May 2011. Facebook post from someone in New Hampshire where I was living at the time as part of the Free State Project. And it was just a link to an article that talked about Bitcoin. And it took two or three articles. Like, after I clicked on it and read about it, I was like, it seemed fishy, because the article was about how this asset had gained like 400% since the prior 3 or 4 months. And like, financial assets don't do that, right? So like, anything that grows at that speed in that amount of time as a financial asset is a scam or a lie, or there's something going on. So it made me very skeptical. But then I looked into it more deeply and realized, like, yes, that was true. And what was amazing, of course, is that like, the biggest growth in Bitcoin's history was still to come. That, like, that was all still nothing. This was when it had gone, you know, like from $1 to $4 or something. So my initial skepticism waned really like within 30 minutes, I think. And I was like, wow, this is so fucking cool. And just got completely obsessed. And then I spent, you know, a week or two just absorbing all the information I could about it. And it's very interesting how much better the mind is at learning even quite complex or technical things if you have an emotional appeal with it.
So sure.
You know, like I don't have any background in cryptography. I'm not an engineer. Many of the concepts in Bitcoin were totally foreign to me, but I learned it pretty quick. And it was because I had like a deep intellectual interest in what it was trying to do. So I think there's an important lesson there. You know, like if you're trying to learn something and you're just finding it really hard, it might be because you just don't care about the thing. And the corollary, of course, is that those things you do care about, you will learn more quickly and you should pursue those passions eagerly.
Yeah.
It says here.
Yeah. Curiosity really is that Promethean fire, right?
That's why I dropped out of college.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would love to ask a few questions about Shapeshift and your relationship with it these days. For those that don't know, I had the pleasure of working with Eric at Shapeshift starting in 2018. And I can hands down say Eric was the best CEO that I ever worked for, not just because he was the only CEO that I worked for. He was awesome.
So I was also the worst.
I didn't think about that.
First and last.
But Eric was amazing. He was just as approachable as a CEO as he was as a person at an AI conference. And you made history when you announced in 2021 that you were stepping down as CEO and handing over Shapeshift to the community and launching a DAO. So I'm curious, what is your relationship to Shapeshift like these days?
Yeah, so when we decided to decentralize, I had to kind of do a lot of deep thinking about like, what do I want my role to be? You know, I wouldn't be formally CEO anymore because there was no corporation. But by default, I would probably still be like leading it unless I took action to do something else. And for two reasons, like I stepped largely aside. One was it had been like an 8-year slog and I really needed a break and some downtime and like reassess the world around me. So that was part of it. And that was just like a natural transition point. But also for it to be decentralized, it really needed to form like a new structure. And it couldn't just be like the same structure that we had as a centralized corporation, but now we're a DAO with all the same people in charge. And so I was like, I need to, if for no other reason, like step back from a formal leadership role in that regard so that this organism, you know, can form in a new way as a decentralized creature. So really for both those reasons, like I stepped way back. I'm very likely still the biggest Fox token holder. And still like it's, you know, less than 5%. So it was very decentralized in that regard from the beginning. And I, you know, promised myself and I think the community that I would, you know, never just like throw my weight around with the tokens I had to sway the votes. So I vote, you know, fairly often, but always with a minority of the tokens and have largely just kind of stepped aside and watch it grow organically as a new DAO. So that's the situation now. I'm a user, like it's the mobile wallet that I have on my desktop and one of the two main wallets I use on my mobile and one of the two main wallets I use on my computer as well. So a user and a fan, but no formal or informal leadership role at all.
Wait,
that's
who is the
really
other
cool.
Very easy.
probably just MetaMask on its own, I would say. You know, it's like
the other Fox.
I only use wallets that have foxes as their logos.
Nice. That's a really interesting transition, Eric, to the DAO structure. I guess my question around that is, you know, through that process for you personally or for Shapeshift before it was transitioned to a DAO, was there any turbulence along the way or any things that you had to work through that were personally or organizationally difficult to navigate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, organizationally, it was really tricky. Because I think we can claim to be the the first VC-backed, you know, normally structured company that decentralized itself completely. And to do that, there were basically three constituencies that had to be made better off by us doing it. Those three were our users, our customers, the employees, and our investors. Like, if any of those three groups got screwed by the transition into a DAO, I wouldn't have felt good about it. So that meant for like the shareholders, they needed to get a return on their money that they had invested in Shapeshift. For the employees, it meant that they needed to get, you know, a decent chunk of the new token in the Fox token, and that they would have an opportunity if they wished, you know, to continue contributing in a meaningful way to the DAO. And then for the users, the customers, it meant for them that they needed to have a continuity of their app. You know, we couldn't like turn the service off for 6 months while we restructured everything. So within those constraints, it was actually quite difficult. You know, like we had enough money on our balance sheet to pay out the investors with a pretty decent return. Plus they got a bunch of tokens. So from their perspective, you know, like while it wasn't the 100x that every investor wants in a startup investment, it was a good multiple and they still had upside in the token if the token did well. And they were, you know, thankfully very open-minded to this new structure. You know, like you can imagine a lot of VCs, especially a couple of years ago, would have been, you know, kind of horrified by the idea that you would just dismantle the corporation. But we were really blessed the whole time we had investors that they were always really ideologically aligned with us, and that helped greatly. So yeah, it was tricky. I mean, oh, and then I guess the fourth constituency is the regulators. You know, like we had to navigate how do we do this without getting in even more trouble, because we were already in a bunch of trouble by then. You know, how do we do this at least without pissing them off further? Or actually, I don't care about pissing them off. How do we do this without breaking laws, right? And getting into trouble in that regard. So that was a fourth set of constraints that was pretty tricky. But, you know, one of my fondest memories of that whole phase is like having a Zoom call with FinCEN, you know, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, one of the main financial regulators in the U.S., and telling them in this call with like, you know, a dozen of us, that we were decentralizing the platform, and to just say that to them, you know, and to tell them why we thought it was perfectly legal. And we like at this point, we really knew our shit. Like I had unfortunately had to become an expert in these rules, and to be able to like just go up to them and tell them what we were doing, and for them to be like, well, okay, thank you for letting us know. And like, they didn't really have any, it was largely because they had no idea what we were even talking about. Like, they'd never come across such a thing. Yeah. But also to the degree that they did understand what we were doing, it was clear that they had no obvious legal objection to it. And that felt great. So yeah, it was super tricky. I mean, the whole process took 6 to 9 months of organizational work before we were able to just decentralize it. And then it took a bunch of work after that point to build the DAO up. And you know, that was a separate project.
And looking back, do you think it was the right decision?
100%.
Yeah.
I certainly made plenty of mistakes with Shapeshift. Decentralizing it was definitely a great move. I wish we had done it earlier. I felt great about that decision.
And man, I wish I could have seen the look on those regulators' faces when you explained.
that's a victory moment right there.
Yeah, it felt great.
All right, last question around Shapeshift, and we can move on to other topics. But I wanted to ask if you have any advice to other companies that are thinking about transitioning or transferring their assets to a DAO.
I'd put them in touch with you, Willie, because you were you were instrumental in helping us do that. I think our decision to decentralize came in no small part from you as a genesis, and both in the idea of it and in the execution, you were invaluable. So first suggestion is talk to Willie, because he really knows this stuff like in the trenches and the tooling to do it. And then to just recognize that like each project is going to be different in how they should decentralize. There's no like cookie cutter process. It's a nuanced topic. It requires a lot of thoughtfulness. And also that not every company should decentralize. You know, I think it's a cool model that works great for some businesses, particularly ones that are purely digital and purely crypto. If you touch anything physical, it gets really hard to structure a DAO, I think, maybe impossible. And if you touch anything fiat related, you can't be a DAO. Fiat here meaning, you know, bank fiat, not stablecoin fiat. Explore the idea with an open mind. And for those who want to do it, you know, like, be thoughtful and work toward it. And yeah, it can be great.
So you get through that transition with Shapeshift. You unplug a little bit. You take some time. What did you get into during your downtime?
Well, I was shocked at how little downtime I actually had. Actually quite dismayed. I was like, well, as soon as I'm not CEO anymore, I'm going to have all this free time and I'm going to get bored. And like, what am I going to do? And the time really gets eaten up. You know, you don't need many hobbies. You don't need many friends. You don't need, you know, many trips to just completely fill up your time. And still, even after we converted into a DAO, I still had a lot of work to do with the entity that was dissolving. So for the next, you know, 6 months at least, I still had a part-time role in getting the corporate entity not just separated from the DAO, but dissolved. And parts of that are actually still ongoing. So I'm not too involved in it at this point, but it's been such a nightmare to just turn the entity off. You know, like, yeah. I didn't realize that would be hard, but so much bureaucracy related to like Swiss corporate structure and things like that. I took a lot of time off, traveled a lot, spent time with friends and family, you know, got back in shape and tried to enjoy life a bit, participated a little in the DAO, participated in the crypto industry generally, which is, you know, this constant fast moving thing that's always hard to keep up with. Had more time for reflection and able to observe the world around me a little more, which was nice. I read a lot more, you know, reading became something I could do again. So that felt good.
I'm curious, did you miss any part of it? You know, like the weird thing is like for all of us, right? Whether you're like part of the core team or you're like the founding person, you kind of get addicted to that grind a little bit. You like get this routine of monotony, but it feels like little victories. I'm just curious, were you like, that was a hard thing to switch off in your mind?
No, not really. I think in large part because we had already been a remote company for a year, you know, post COVID. So that all those habits of like being at the office and in person, many of those I missed after we separated into being remote. But that habit was all broken by the time we decentralized the company itself. So that, I think that helped to a degree. But yeah, I was really ready for like a change of scene and pace. And certainly I miss, you know, like the Fox fam and all getting together. But I also see a lot of the people that were involved with some regularity. And some of the people I'm close with, you know, like great friends, and I still see them often. So that's all still there.
That's cool.
And hearing you talk about that, it makes me miss the CBD coffee in the office and the kombucha.
I miss the office Towerfall games, you know, like that kind of stuff was all great. We had a lot of fun at a centralized company with an office, and you know, there's a certain camaraderie, and we went through hell for a couple of years, and that has a way of, you know, like bringing people together. So I certainly miss that.
What are you working on these days?
I started getting interested in the AI stuff. And in particular, started realizing like that all the challenges that crypto finance deals with from a regulatory perspective, you know, like this tension between individuals having permissionless access to a powerful system, which is what Bitcoin and cryptocurrency represents, and then the regulations which are written such that powerful system is by its nature illegal, right? Like Bitcoin itself is illegal from any sense of the desire and goal of how financial regulations works. And that tension is really intense. And I care about permissionless systems very deeply. I believe that if a person is not even accused of a crime, they should be free. They shouldn't be spied on. They should just be free. If they have not harmed someone else or even been accused of harming someone else, they should obviously just be free. Like, I don't know why that's such an extreme position to take. Like, that makes me a radical extremist by thinking that, which sucks.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, that's one of my core principles. And so when I started learning about generative AI and seeing like how powerful that was, at first it was just like a cool toy that I was like enjoying playing with. But of course, anything interesting, the government wants to get its hands on. And I started seeing the trajectory of, you know, large language model inference being pulled into the gravitational well of regulations. And this came to a head back in the fall with the executive order from the US government basically saying like, they're going to cap the parameters of models. They're going to likely require licensing of AI companies in various ways. People have not paid enough attention to that executive order or the downstream regulations that will come, some starting as soon as this summer. But my like, you know, rebellious anti-government spirit really got perked again. And I was like, you know what? I don't think these AI people, as smart as they are, understand what's coming, you know, because a lot of them have come from an academic world, and they haven't been like born in the cauldron of regulatory fire like the crypto folks have. So long-winded answer, but basically I've gotten interested in AI, and in particular in helping AI be decentralized and thus permissionless. So I'm quite involved in a project called Morpheus, which hasn't launched yet, still in development. But it's essentially a decentralized AI network. No corporation involved, which I love. It's a decentralized project, open source from top to bottom. And it really like carries the ethos of crypto that I care about so much into the AI world. And so I wanted to contribute to that and help make it a thing. So that's where my focus is.
Very cool. For the listeners out there, we did do another episode with David Johnston. He gave us a little bit of a high level on the issue, but I'm curious about your perspective on what's happening from a regulatory perspective and what this executive order means for the AI landscape. Can you just give us like the 40,000 foot?
Yeah. So we'll just narrow the conversation to like generative AI, because AI is a broad field, right? Generative AI is basically like what people are used to using with ChatGPT, where you send in, you know, a question or you want an image, and the amazing AI machine sends you back an incredibly elaborate answer or an image that it created, you know, right on the moment. Obviously, incredibly powerful technology. It can, you know, do code, and then OpenAI just released, what's it called? Sora, the video.
Sora, creator, yeah.
Which is amazing. Like, we amazing are, and we are scary. Living in the future. So amazing, yeah. So scary, so wild that it's possible. Like, it seems like we're looking at technology that should have been 30 or 40 years away, and it's here. And it's so powerful that I think there are a lot of people that want to capture it and regulate it. The charitable take is that some people are just legitimately scared of the consequences, and they want, you know, daddy government to like protect them. The less charitable take is that, to the degree you can capture this stuff and license it, the incumbents will be entrenched, and they will have a license to maintain their lead, you know, into the indefinite future. And I think one of the ways this gets expressed is that the models that are trained, that people run inference against, are going to end up getting licensed. Or stated differently, you will be required to have a license to offer AI LLM inference service to customers. And that license will stipulate, you know, which models you can use. Those models, of course, will have to be government approved, which means they will be censored in small ways, large ways, benign ways, very dangerous ways. But you will only be able to access this kind of intelligent machine with the permission of the state, with the permission of politicians. And to me, that's wholly unethical. Like, there is no person in Washington that is such good of a person that they have the right to prevent me from accessing intelligence. Just like they should not have the right to prevent me from accessing books. Exact same thing. Or songs, right? Or like emotions, or, you know, like these are, or mathematics. These are all powerful things which obviously can be used for evil. You know, every great war in history was powered in part by mathematics, right? Should we license it? Should we license mathematics and make sure that only good people are using mathematics? I don't think so. Most people would find that preposterous. And yet when there's a new thing that comes along, whether it's Bitcoin, you know, permissionless money or generative AI, people suddenly believe that like it needs to be regulated. That's just their default position. Like, new powerful thing must be regulated, must be licensed. Like, the government will take care of us. I think this is a very dangerous religion. It's fundamentally anti-American. And the only way around it, in my experience, is to decentralize things and prevent the ability of the state to capture and regulate it. So I think this is becoming as important for AI as it is for money. And so I'm becoming equally passionate about both.
How do you think we navigate? Everything you're saying makes sense to me. And I agree with your perspective on anti-regulatory stances with AI. But I'm curious what your take is on how we as a society navigate this technology, just your personal opinion about how do we embrace this in a way that's going to make society better? I mean, it's not all going to be better, obviously, but do you have a perspective on ways that we can self-govern this technology to make sure that we don't blow ourselves up?
Yeah, I mean, first, a good principle is to like see where harm is actually being done to people in a coercive or involuntary manner. So to my knowledge, like, AI hasn't killed anyone. But a lot of people are like, oh, well, it might kill a bunch of people. Okay, maybe we should consider that point, but it hasn't killed anyone. And empirically, that's important. So perhaps try to find the places where it's actually causing damage, like,
right.
And real damage, right? Where there's actually a victim. Like, find where a victim is and then try to figure out reasonable rules to prevent more victims.
Right.
Blanket licensure, because you don't want victims to happen in the future, sounds good, but is first at best highly likely to thwart the growth of the industry. And the unseen cost of this, like when you curtail the advancement of a technology, all the benefits that would have occurred if it had been unleashed, or a large portion of the benefits don't happen, and you don't see that they don't happen. This is the concept of the unseen that the 19th century French philosopher Bastiat liked to popularize. You don't see what doesn't happen when you curtail a technology. You don't see the good stuff that would have happened that now didn't. And there's like something fundamentally, I think, immoral about preventing ourselves tomorrow and our future generations from those unseen benefits because we're afraid of unseen costs today. So like as a philosophical framework, I think that's a good place to start.
Right.
You know, I'm a human. I don't want AI to wipe out humanity from the earth. Like, you know, I don't think it will. There's a lot of scary sci-fi movies about this, but, it hasn't actually caused any harm, any material harm yet. And just because someone loses their job because a better system comes along, that's not harm, right? Like, if you're going to argue that, then we should also get rid of shovels because they,
right.
You know, prevented, they caused a lot of people that worked on the farm to get, you know, to lose their jobs once you could dig with a shovel instead of your hands.
Yeah.
Tools are really important, and good tools will put a lot of people out of work. And that's actually incredibly important for productivity and bringing down the cost of living and making society wealthier. People that don't understand that basic premise of economics, like, just fundamentally should be nowhere near regulations in the beginning, because they're just going to screw up the economy and cause poverty. So, yeah, I'm kind of rambling, but that's a good start.
Yeah. Great take.
So I guess like my next question is like, how do we just get involved? I mean, what are the different phases? You said it's like still in development. So like, what's the deal? What do we need to do? Get off the bench and like get in the game.
You mean with Morpheus specifically?
Yeah, with Morpheus or with life, man. Like, yeah.
I think so. For those who are interested in AI, which is most people these days, and who care about permissionless and open source AI, which is at least many people in the crypto world, a good way to start is just to like go learn about the open source models. Right. So everyone's aware of like OpenAI and ChatGPT and some of the big models from like Google, but there's a bunch of open source models that get created by big companies. Like, you know, Facebook has probably created the best one. Mistral is a big company in France that's produced a really good one. And then there's like hundreds or thousands of these models, and some of them are really, really good. And you can run these things on your own desktop computer with a pretty small degree of technical acuity. And so just to learn that can be done, like download one of these models from, you know, Ollama and try it on your computer and just see how that works and how it compares to something like ChatGPT. Learning some of those tools, I think, is good. You know, like one of the best ways to learn Bitcoin back in the day is to just download a node and like get some Bitcoin and send it to someone. Use the thing, right? Same principle with a bicycle. I could tell you about a bicycle all day long. Like you could read a whole textbook on bicycles, but if you haven't just gotten on the bicycle, you're not going to understand it. So go try out open source AI tools as a good starting point. Morpheus in particular is meant to be a network that incentivizes inference and computational power in a decentralized way. Right now, it's in a bootstrapping phase where the token is being released, but no one can trade it yet. And the software that routes the inference requests between users and compute providers is being built as we speak. All of it is open source and done in the open. So people that think this kind of stuff is cool should join the Morpheus Discord and try to get involved. Find the open source code repos, contribute to it, you know, like spend time learning about who's involved and what's getting worked on. There are token rewards that people can earn by contributing to it. And just learn about it and get involved in the community and see where it takes you.
You had me at token rewards.
You didn't say incentivized.
Y'all have convinced me that it's worse for the government to regulate AI than more beneficial. But I will say, I'm still a little bit afraid of super intelligent AI, you know, maybe not being benevolent, similar to how I'm afraid of the government.
I think that's reasonable.
I do think I think it's a free market to solve that than I would in the government being able to permit that.
Yeah, it's like, I think one danger is that the debate gets cast between people who worry that AI can be dangerous and people who assume it is safe, right? Or people that assume it'll be dangerous and people that assume it'll be safe. Right. First of all, no one should assume anything. Like, this technology is brand new, very weird, moving very quickly. No one should have surety that it will be safe. And how do you define that? And no one should have surety that it will be dangerous. Like, just have some humility that we don't know how it will unfold, first of all. But second, even if you are very worried about it being dangerous, which I think is a reasonable intellectual position, it's not clear that the way you solve that is by centralizing it, right? And putting it behind closed doors. If you're worried about AI, or, you know, to use Terminator, which is that great movie where the AI escaped and like destroyed humanity, the AI in that, the Skynet, as it was called, was created by a centralized closed source technology company called Cyberdyne, right, in the movie?
That's right.
Cyberdyne is this like this technology company with this closed source internal AI project that escaped. It was not an open source project, right? Cyberdyne was not open source. Open source projects have an ability, because they can be seen by anyone on Earth, and not only seen, but anyone that studies the system can learn how it works. There is a reasonable argument that that kind of system will always be, or often be, safer because everyone can see it. You just have more eyes on it. If you're worried about AI being dangerous, there's a good argument that you should be in favor of open source AI for that reason alone.
Right.
There should be more safetyists, as they're called, that are safetyist and pro open source. Like, that's a reasonable position to take. And indeed, there's reasons that, like, you know, the vast majority of servers on Earth that run so much important infrastructure are run on open source Linux software. It's because it's safer. You can find the bugs earlier. That same principle applies with AI. So I would like to see more people that had that safetyist alarmism, but then their conclusion was, and thus we need it to be open source. And that's a good direction.
Great points. I would also add, to err on the side of caution, just be nice to the AIs, you know, make sure you're always thank ChatGPT.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. Yeah. I always say please and thank you when I'm talking with these things. Just keeps you being a good human, right? Like, these things are becoming human-like. They're obviously still just like language calculators. I don't think they're anywhere close to being conscious, and we don't really even have a definition of what that means, but they start to seem human. And if you treat something that seems human with like a cold neglect, it kind of reflects on you a little bit.
Yeah.
You know? So like, just, yes, be nice to the AI systems, not just because the AI cares, because it probably doesn't, at least not yet, but it just is like a good reminder to be a polite human yourself. And if you lose your own humanity, then really, what are you worried about with the AI?
Yeah, great point. What's your favorite use for AI in your personal life, Eric? How are you using it most these days?
I've realized that it's actually become the better search engine. Yeah, I think this is like an underappreciated point. I'm starting to not use Google as a search engine very often. When I have a question about something, I find ChatGPT is better, usually. And that's quite amazing. I think like it has all sorts of novelty for like fun and interesting answers you can get about stuff. And it has expert knowledge on some really deep topics, but it's just better at search. If I was Google, I would be terrified.
Yeah,
they had this like dominant, completely dominant, unassailable position. You know, they're called a monopoly by everyone. But the market has a way of chipping away at monopolies. And, OpenAI kind of came out of nowhere and now suddenly has the best internet search engine in some ways.
Yeah.
So that's what I use it for. I think it's quite powerful.
Has anyone tried the new Google Notebook LLM?
Not yet.
It lets you, you can upload like personal docs. You can attach it to your drive and it'll go through and basically answer questions based on your own repository of information, which given that it's Google, I'm not sure how I feel about that, but I like the idea of that.
So great point, right? So on the surface, that sounds very cool, but most people should be a little suspicious and a little worried that like, okay,
absolutely,
to give all of my documents like over to the centralized closed source company. Another reason to support like open source AI is because you can just like have it locally. You can just run your own AI on your own computer with your own documents. And I hope, and I think people will increasingly care about that, because I would love to have the benefit of an AI operating on the knowledge of all my documents, but I don't trust any other central party. Not because they're necessarily trying to be, you know, bad, but they can get hacked or something can happen. And once they have the data, they will always have it. You know,
right.
Like once your data goes to Google, it's theirs forever. You know, same with Apple.
Well, and what I'm guessing a lot of people don't realize is that once you cross, because this is a beta app, and so once you cross that divide from your Google Drive to Notebook, buried somewhere in the TOS, I'm sure you're giving away access to all of that data that you may have not have given away without doing that. And a lot of people aren't going to realize that.
Yeah. And I think it's totally fine if someone wants to do that. It's their data, they can do what they want, but people should be thoughtful about it and they should recognize what they're doing. And I want there to be alternatives. So open source is really key there.
This seems like a perfect thing for someone to build a RAG on Morpheus, right? Just build a retrieval augmentation engine and just launch it on Morpheus. You get a few tokens. Maybe that's something.
You want to build this afterwards?
Yeah, let's just put this on the board. Yeah.
Do it. Yeah. I mean, that hopefully if Morpheus is done well, like it will incentivize people to build those kind of things, you know, to build something like what Google just did, but for your own local device and drive. And anyone listening to this, like it's all open source. Go start building that. It'll be really, really useful.
Awesome. And where are you plugged into the project? I guess what pieces are you working on or thinking about?
Well, so I've been involved in like trying to better define some of the tokenomics. So its initial model of like how it incentivized compute, I thought would not work. At best was not optimal, and at worst probably wouldn't work at all. So I like went in and kind of wrote a suggested complete change to how the tokenomics of compute provisioning works. And I released a paper called the Yellowstone model from Morpheus, because I was flying over Yellowstone Park while I wrote it on the airplane. So I tried to contribute like at the fundamental level to make sure those tokenomics were sound, because without that, the whole project's going to fail. And then beyond that, you know, just like advising the people that are involved in it, good ideas, bad ideas, giving my thoughts on a lot of the economic points. I don't have any particular expertise in AI. I think I have a decent understanding of like economics generally and token economics to a good degree. And so I've been trying to contribute and define and tweak those mechanisms carefully. And then, yeah, I'm going to be building an app on top of it. So I'm also going to be using Morpheus like as a foundation to build an app. So kind of both of those worlds.
Very cool. In the Yellowstone model, so I read the explainer before we did the interview with David. And I recall that there's this interesting dynamic after the first epoch. There's a bit of supply, or it's not remaining supply. I guess it's part of the fee that goes back to, it continues to incentivize compute post the emission period, the initial emission period. Is that, can you walk us through that a little bit?
Not quite. So emissions like Bitcoin started from zero. So there's no like token creation event with a bunch of tokens, like started from point of zero, which happened a week and a half ago. Okay. And the emissions occur, you know, every block for many years. The first 90 days, the tokens aren't transferable. That's the bootstrapping period. But the curve of emissions is a smooth asymptotic curve that maxes out at 42 million. And a portion, roughly a quarter of those tokens go into what's called the compute contract. And the compute contract is what pays for compute on the network. We can get into more details on how that works if you want, but that's the quick idea there.
Okay. That's great.
Well, I didn't know you were building an app there. Excited to see what you build. I know a lot of ATX DAO members are talking about building apps there as well, because the intersection of crypto and AI seems like a pretty exciting and important place to be over the coming years. And I think so too. They can use our help. We've been in the trenches. We understand the importance of decentralization.
I feel like the crypto guys are like the ones putting the wet work now. You know, we're doing the dirty work. I feel like they're nice, beautiful towers of academia, and like now we really understand, like, this is how you deploy this, bro. You know,
it keeps springing to mind that scene from the Batman movie with Bane where he's like, where he says, I was born in the dark. I feel like the crypto people were born in this, you know, like what's referred to as the dark forest of like an assumption of constant adversity. And it's like a world of game theory, a world where no one trusts each other. And with those assumptions, a whole bunch of interesting things can get built. And, you know, it all starts from like Satoshi's white paper about removing trust from the core monetary system. So crypto people come from that world of not trusting each other and building systems with that assumption. The AI world come from largely an academic background, in which people are known. They trust each other. It hasn't been highly commercialized until very recently. And suddenly now, like, it's going to become regulated and adversarial with various states, governments. So yeah, I feel like these two groups like really have a lot to teach each other. And it's a cool pairing. It's, you know, there's a lot of people that really understand the importance of like open, permissionless access to machine intelligence and open permissionless access to money. And the moral justification for both is really the same, but the systems to do it are also similar. And so there's good cross-pollination happening.
I didn't realize we'd have to work with academics though. That makes it a little bit less appealing.
Dude. The lab coat.
Good point. Okay, I'm back in.
Lab coats and flip-flops, bro. We're just trading the hoodies away.
Great point. So I saw that you went to Antarctica recently. So I want to change subjects. What inspired that?
Well, my girlfriend and I were invited to go to Antarctica by one of her friends. And it was never something I thought like I would do. I didn't even consider whether if that was a bucket list thing or not. I hadn't like conceived of a trip to Antarctica. But of course, hearing about the invitation, I was like, well, yes, I must go. So yeah, I was there about 3 weeks ago, 3-4 weeks ago, and it was incredible. Lots of people like go down to Antarctica on a cruise ship and they see the coast and they might go ashore for a few hours. We flew from Cape Town about 100 kilometers off the coast or in the coast, camped there. It was like a very luxurious camp. We were definitely not roughing it. And then we did an overnight trip down actually to the South Pole, which is a whole additional thing. And that was, so like Cape Town to Antarctica, where our camp was a 5.5-hour flight. Flying later in a smaller turboprop plane from our camp to the South Pole was a 7.5-hour additional flight.
Wow.
So 7.5 hours in a turboprop?
Yeah.
That's like a long flight.
It was a long, yeah. Wow. So Antarctica is massive. People don't realize it. It's a whole continent. It's very big. Incredibly surreal and beautiful landscape. You know, it's like nothing else I've ever seen. And where we camped, you know, we were sitting on 1.5 miles thick of ice. You know, you're on a constant permanent glacier and there's mountain peaks that come up even above that ice. But you have to realize that like the mountains go 1 or 2 kilometers further down that you can't even see because they're buried in the ice. So it's just a very, very strange and interesting place. There's no plants at all other than some lichen on the rocks. There's a few birds, you know, there's some penguins near the coast. That's it. It's desolate and it's beautiful. And, wow. It's a very special trip.
Wow.
Something just
random question, but how quiet was it at the South Pole?
Very quiet. Yeah. Bet. There's no like, no hustle and bustle of the city. It's, it's very surreal.
Is there environmental noise
like
though?
Burning Man in some ways. Environmental noise?
What about the penguins? I mean, polar bears?
I guess water, penguins, yeah.
We were there a little late in the season for there to be many penguins, and they were not anywhere close to our camp anyway. An occasional sound of a bird, but very rarely. There's no polar bears in Antarctica. They're all at the North Pole. No, there's not really any animal sounds. It is silent and eerie.
Yeah, you should have left an iPod there with a solar panel that just plays like rain sounds or like the Beastie Boys, like on just loop.
be that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I could be that guy. We did take a
24-hour stream.
We did take a flag down to the South Pole, a Bitcoin flag. I need to post a picture of this.
Oh,
we took a Bitcoin flag and got a picture of it like in the circle of all the national flags, like down at the South Pole. So probably the first Bitcoin flag to ever fly down there. That felt nice.
Cool. This might be a dumb question, but I feel like you'll know. Is there any like regulatory body that governs Antarctica, or is it the wild, wild west?
So a little of both. There was a treaty that happened like a few decades ago between like 8 or 9 countries, and essentially none of them can claim territory or deny each other access to it. And depending on where you are in Antarctica, the rules of those various partner countries could apply to you. So it's kind of a weird hybrid, but it's actually like a good example of international cooperation that has worked for decades. I don't believe there's controversy or many problems. So the large governments of the world, at least in one place down at the bottom of the earth, have managed to like, cooperate with each other. So it's the exception that proves the rule, I guess.
It's the penguins holding the line. They're like, don't fuck around. We'll kick you out of here. You're going to have to swing back.
It's a permissionless continent.
Yeah. Well, I did discover that there's all sorts of interesting conspiracies about Antarctica, including like a lost city that's inhabited by Nazis. And the flat earthers have a lot of opinions about Antarctica. They believe there's a big wall down there that you can't get past. Most of the conspiracies convey that there's like places in Antarctica that you can't go. From my empirical assessment of my experience there, nothing of any of those has any merit. You can go anywhere, but obviously it's a large logistical challenge, and you have to be very careful. And you know, a lot of people die doing the wrong thing down there. But
so you're telling us you didn't find the Truman Show wall?
No, I was really hoping to find like the lost Nazi city. That would have been really interesting to see from the air, but I didn't see it.
I guess another question we have to ask is that, like, well, we're going to switch back to crypto, right? I love the Antarctica thing. Actually, one last question. Really wanted to know, Austin or Antarctica, which one would you prefer? Which one, I guess, is a summer place for you?
Better place to visit. For
Well, to visit, of course, like Antarctica is way cooler. But to live, like you can't live there. You know, like it's like living on Mars. Like it felt like Mars colony, where everything has to be brought in and brought back at great expense. Infrastructure is incredibly minimal. So in that way, it was similar to Burning Man, in that like you can have the illusion of civilization at great expense for a temporary period of time, but there's no persistent infrastructure or development there. Mm. So but very different vibe than Austin, I would say.
The way you're describing it, I feel like it's that James Bond, like the world is not enough ice castle, you know, that just gets built up for whatever. And then like every year it just gets ruined and they build it up again. But in this one, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. The space laser. Well,
there was actually like an ice bar that was created by the company that we were touring with. This was like a very nice, this could have been like a nightclub in northern Finland or something, like made entirely of ice with a bar. And like, so people do all sorts of really creative things in desolate wastelands, but none of it is permanent. And I think they have to rebuild that bar like every 2 years or so. And of course, while we were there, it was sunshine nonstop because it's the summer. Mm. But there are people that man the research stations during the winter. So imagine like being in sheer darkness for 4 months with like a group of 10 or 12 people. You can't leave. Like you can't fly back during the time. There was some crazy story that I learned about a woman. She was like the doctor with a team over the winter, and she developed breast cancer while she was there. She ended up operating on herself, and like it was all fine. She did it. But it was like that's the kind of self-sufficiency that these people have. And to live in darkness for months sounds, I'd be willing to try it once, but I bet it's pretty scary and strange.
I think I'll just stick to the Antarctic cruise. You know, that might just
be well, also I read like the Shackleton story while I was there.
Oh yeah.
Shackleton was this English explorer who tried to be the first team to transnavigate the continent, and the excursion went horribly wrong. I won't ruin anything, but it's an incredible story of leadership and resilience and survival. And it just makes you realize like how easy we have it in the modern age. Right? Even the people that are at the research station, like they have diesel fuel and food, like aplenty, you know, like they have so many luxuries and things that we take for granted now, even in that situation. People in the past really, really were hardcore. Like we can't really at all understand like what humans normally dealt with and did. And we have it so comfortably now. And I think that's okay as long as we like appreciate it and think about it and realize where that comes from, and like that it's due to wealth and markets, and we should be grateful for that and we should pay more attention to it.
Yeah, 100%. Let's put it in perspective. So you've obviously been to some cool places, and I think you've probably visited a lot of crypto communities around the world. I'm curious, I know you've been to Austin's crypto scene. How does Austin's crypto scene compare to these other communities? We've got a lot of pride, but we also want to make it one of the top crypto scenes, so we're open for feedback for anything we can improve.
I feel like it had a great vibe, like especially now that you have a couple of the big conferences happening down there. And Texas just has a different culture than much of the US, which I think it's not surprising to me that like one of the best crypto hubs in the US is in Texas. There's just a greater spirit of independence there that I wish was more common in the rest of the country. And so obviously that's going to mesh well with the spirit of permissionless finance. It's interesting that New York kind of like killed itself from a crypto perspective. Like it should have been the center of finance in the 21st century. It had all the momentum. It was certainly the center in the 20th century, but largely thanks to Ben Losky and the BitLicense, you know, back in 2013 or 14, yeah. The number of startups that are crypto there, like per capita, is so far below what it should be. And that loss has really been to the advantage of alternative cities, Austin being one of the main ones.
We heard about these network states and these city DAOs. Curious if you have any thoughts just on the concept of city DAOs or potential for these network states.
Yeah, network states are a cool idea. I love seeing people experimenting with like new forms of governments. I think that's great. You know, radical, most of them will absolutely fail, and that's fine. Whenever you see like a bunch of things failing, that's a good sign because it means that people are experimenting. When you see little failure around you, it means you've found yourself in a stagnant place.
Yeah.
So I love the freshness of the thinking. I want to see these network states bloom and blossom and fail. And there's a lot of good lessons, I think, that can be learned from them. The large centralized nation state model, we can debate whether it was a good idea in the 20th century, but I think forms of governance change as technology changes. And smaller city state models or online governance models and or DAOs, like I think there's a lot of there's a lot of wisdom in this stuff that will be apparent in the future. And so it's just starting now. It's been exciting to see that. But of course, the centralized governments aren't going to let that evolution happen peacefully. You know, they're all bankrupt. They're all in horrible debt. And they're going to like try to claw the resources out of people as much as they can and screaming and kicking all the way down.
It feels like we're going from the techno-feudalist to techno-capitalist era, right?
Hopefully
that's what it is.
I would love to see a techno-capitalist era. You know, the internet largely is that, and crypto is that, but it doesn't translate very well to the terrestrial realm because governments claim this monopoly on violent aggression. But yeah, I would love a near future where we have like actual techno-capitalism. I think the growth you see and the material well-being from that is incredibly powerful. And whatever you think the problems of the world are, you can solve a lot of things with a wealthier society.
I mean, we're moving from like a pretty heavy subject back to like Bitcoin. So I just wanted to see what your take is on all the crazy ordinal and inscription action and all that stuff that's happening on Bitcoin with ordinals and runes and stamps and all this crazy new meta protocol stuff. I was just curious, like, do you have a take or it's like, you know, hopefully it doesn't break my heart.
Again, same thing with the network states. I just love seeing the experimentation. Bitcoin really ossified in terms of its development culture for years, like especially as Ethereum came out and people could build smart contracts on Ethereum. A lot of the developers that wanted to build applications moved over to Ethereum. And then sort of as like a cultural response, the Bitcoin world became very much like a culture of anti-innovation. And I understand where some of that comes from, like the conservative development path of Bitcoin, I think there's wisdom to it. But it's true that like the culture of Ethereum was much more about building and moving fast and innovating, whereas Bitcoin was more stagnant. And now it's very interesting to see a lot of people like starting to build on Bitcoin again. Some new protocols and innovations are letting that happen. There's half a dozen credible projects trying to do an EVM on Bitcoin. I love all of it. And again, lots of it will fail, and that's totally cool. It's just great to see the innovation and, you know, like free markets and money and financial systems just moving so quickly. You know, like it's the regulators are so screwed, like they and the banks and the banks, like think of all the innovation that banks have had in the last 20 years. Right. It's like almost none. Mm-hmm. And yet if you try to keep track of crypto projects and how much they change and all the new primitives getting built and like what they're doing, it's just a different league. And banks are already obviously dinosaurs. The regulators are obviously, they're regulating a world that like has already moved beyond them. Like, or to use a metaphor, they're like regulating the earth when the most interesting parts of society have taken off in the rocket ships and they're now in space.
Yeah.
And as someone who like vehemently despises the federal government, I love that. I love the impotence, which over the coming years, these regulators will just one by one start to understand about themselves. And for all the harm that they've caused, and all for all the self-serving pompousness that they live under, I feel like there's a great sense of justice in like power moving away from these central coercive entities and back toward the market. So yeah, bring all the innovation out on every chain and, you know, let the markets do their thing.
Nice.
Solana included?
Sure. Solana might have a bunch of good use cases, right? Like it obviously has its problems. It's not Bitcoin. It's not Ethereum. It's something else. But yeah, let it rise or fail, and it might find some really good niches. And all these things are better than fiat, you know. Like, So, yeah, I like seeing the experimentation. It's very intellectually exciting and philosophically validating.
Never a dull day.
Apart from price action and number go up, what are you most excited about with this coming cycle?
I'm not sure. You know, it's not like I'm that excited about the ETF. I think it's going to have a big consequence and a good consequence generally, but it doesn't excite me. It's really just like there's not like some new narrative. It's just like the volatile progression of decentralized finance generally. You know, it's the decentralized protocols that are always most exciting to me. To me, like DeFi wasn't a summer. DeFi is the whole point. Bitcoin was the first DeFi project, and every new mechanism people find to extend the permissionlessness of Bitcoin as narrow money to something more advanced in the realm of finance is really the theme that I care most about. And certainly now the like crossover between crypto and AI and bringing like a permissionless foundation to AI inference is what most of my attention is going toward. But that's just, you know, one branch of the whole crypto story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
It's cool to see. It's got to be so cool from your perspective to see how far the industry has come. So I'm curious, do you have any words of wisdom for those who are entering their first or maybe their second bull market?
Well, yeah. You have to find a balance between like riding the bull and the spaceship during the bull market and being responsible. No one should have all their wealth in crypto, even the most bullish person. All these systems can fail. All these markets can crash disastrously. You should take some profits at certain points and make sure your life is in order. You know, make sure your debt is manageable. Make sure you have like physical assets. Not that they're better than crypto assets, they're just different. And don't get sucked up into the hype. You know, like, during the bear market, like people believe this stuff isn't working at all when the value is there. And during the bull market, people believe it's all like a panacea when there are actual problems. And you just have to see through the hype and the crowds in both cases. Enjoy the bull market. You know, don't get greedy. Like you can get rich very quickly in crypto by just like literally holding Bitcoin, which is the most boring concept of all. People don't really need to do more than that. And if you're going to do more than that, just be really, really careful. My general advice to like new people is own 50-50 Bitcoin ETH, keep it safe, learn how to use it responsibly. And you don't need to do anything more than that. That's it, you know? And when you own that stuff, you'll start to learn some of these systems and you can branch out, you know, where appropriate and with time and education, but don't go chasing some new like meme coin just because you think you missed out on Bitcoin and Ethereum. It's like so many people have wrecked themselves doing that. If you want to gamble, cool, go gamble, recognize your gambling. But if you want to actually like have a meaningful stake in the revolution, own some Bitcoin, own some ETH, and don't be dumb.
Incredibly wise words. It's so cool that you've seen the industry come how far it's come. And when you first started, it was very much in its infancy. It was super hard to get Bitcoin and you helped with that with BitInstant. But now it almost feels like with this cycle, like we are finally ready potentially for the masses to come on board. Like we've got L2s that can scale. People can on-ramp onto L2s and off-ramp onto L2s. So it really does feel like we are finally, for the first time really, actually ready for masses to come on chain. Like we can fit them in blocks, which we couldn't really do in the past cycles. You think we might see more masses come on chain in this next cycle?
Yes, but that answer is true with each cycle. With each cycle, the infrastructure is better such that it supports more people than the prior one. So yes, but also it's always true. And I don't think that the infrastructure is ready for 8 billion people. I don't think this cycle is where like everyone in the world is using crypto all the time, but that's fine. Like these things happen in fits and starts. And, you know, if we go from like 100 million normal crypto users to like 500 million normal crypto users in this cycle, that's awesome. That's huge. This stuff is moving at the speed that the market wants it to move. And frankly, like if it goes too quickly and adoption happens too quickly, you might end up having the like frog in the boiling pot situation where governments just freak out and try to ban it. I think it's good that it has a degree of slowness to it, even though by any historical account, it's all still happening pretty quickly.
We appreciate your time, Eric. It's been a great conversation. Thanks for making time for us in your life.
Yeah, this has been a great conversation. So thanks for having me on.